I have 85. Do I have 90? I have 90 from the man with the face at table 4.
This is terrible. You don't know what you're doing.
Adam Sandler?
Yeah, that's right. I collect antiquities. I'm a serious person. I'm writing a movie right now about the Russian Revolution.
Oh, really? Who does Kevin James play in it?
It's a serious movie. Trotsky.
Ah, there it is.
TBTL!
Hey, somebody has run out on the field. Some goofball in a hat and a red shirt. Now he takes off the shirt. He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. Now he runs the opposite way. He runs at the 50. He runs at the 40. The guy is drunk, but there he goes.
Paint your bald spot?
I don't. Do you paint your bald spot?
Paint your bald spot?
You sick.
The world of cheeses is strange and intimidating, and frankly, it's terrifying to me.
Sometimes a little comic relief is the best way to deliver a serious message.
I don't believe you're seriously considering listening to these men.
Listen to that horn! Oh my God! Oh, she's beautiful! She is beautiful! Yeah!
This party is gonna be off the hook.
You ready, Rudog? All right, everybody, this is special. This is special. It's a Thursday afternoon edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Peace and love. Peace and love.
My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
How is it that we always end up talking about buttholes at this poker game?
Because it's an amazing poker game, I think. It's also episode 2493 in a collector series coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill in Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City. Man, I know we've probably, for those of you listening in other parts of the country and or listening to this months from now, I'm sure we've been leaning in too much to the story about the big dark, the rain and wind storm that has spanned from China to the Pacific Northwest. China. I'll never say that word normal again. But another rainy day here. And of course, at the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, we historically have had some water intrusion in the basement. So as I sit here recording this imaginary radio show, I also have one quadrant of my brain down in the basement worrying about if my ping pong table is getting flooded or not. Hopefully not.
Oh my God!
Because if we lose the rumpus room at this place, my good friend Andrew Walsh will never visit again. Hopefully it won't come to that. Here's the plan for today's show. We have a lot to talk about.
Let the fun begin.
What if you were a dog selected by the CIA to learn how to sniff out bombs? But then one day you decided that's not the life for you. You don't want to be a bomb-sniffing dog.
I'll say, what's up, dog?
Well, you'd be like a new dog we just met named Lulu. We'll tell you more about Lulu's strange journey to and away from the CIA bomb-sniffing program. Also, scientists say that they have found now, they have detected and tested the perfect spot on the moon to build an underground moon colony.
I heard the jury's still out on science.
It's these lava tubes that they say are just perfectly set up for us to get up there and colonize the moon. So that makes that seem like it's a little bit more possible. We will get into that. Also, Matthew McConaughey is getting some internet attention today because he was giving a pep talk to the University of Texas men's basketball team.
When you got God, you got a friend, and that friend is you.
McConaughey loves to show up and give like kind of bizarre motivational speeches to the various Texas athletic programs. I believe he did go to the University of Texas, so he's a booster. But he was inadvertently doing a power pose, and the internet saw this picture of Matthew McConaughey power posing, and they started talking about it. It had me thinking about a very interesting article in the New York Times Magazine about the inventor, or I should say the researcher who identified the power pose, and how there's some real scientific debate now around that whole situation. So we'll get into that too, plus emails and vmails. And a conversation with this young man. He's the Hodor of podcasting. He's also one of the founding partners of Walsh, Walsh & Doormat. He bought a balloon, but it doesn't mean he thinks he's better than anyone else. He might have tacos tonight. He's not quite sure. And he's outlasted them all. I'll tell you what, he is officially the longest-running co-host of this program.
It's a tough but rewarding job, one that takes years to move into.
He's Andrew Walsh, and he joins us from the Wallingford neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Hello, my dude.
I leave a trail of podcast co-hosts behind me everywhere I go.
Yeah. And you have your catchphrase as you survey the landscape of your vanquished foes.
And tell them the bone sent you.
No, mine is, you know it, baby. That's mine. You're confusing me with Jay Buhner again.
Oh, dang it.
Right, no.
If we can get Jay Buhner on tape saying, you know it, baby.
Oh, my God.
Then that's it. Then the universe folds in on itself, right? I mean, that's we retire at that point.
There are less possible quests in our lives. Like, we know a lot of people who know Jay Buhner, right? We know the radio station where he probably cuts some of those damn spots. Maybe not. Do you think he goes to a studio, like some sort of a? You're in the commercial business. When you have somebody like Jay Buhner, a former athlete and now commentator. And he's doing local Trucktober. Happy Trucktober, by the way, Luke.
Blessed Trucktober to you and yours, by the way.
Thank you. When he's recording, tell him the bone sent you. Is he going to one of the local radio stations and cutting that? Or do you think that he's actually in the studios of some ad agency where they're like, I need that more purple?
Let me listen to this here.
Trucks, and Trucktober.
Oh, he's
that
at a
sounds
concert.
Like he did in a studio. Yeah. I think he probably goes to a studio. The reason is because I don't see a guy like The Bone, like, what, setting up or even hiring someone to set up a recording studio at his house where he has to then go in and, like, turn on the microphone and start rolling in GarageBand.
No. I figured, he's not recording himself, but do you think he's going to your Kairos or Comos or KJRs of the world, going to the radio stations where these are airing and he's recording them there, or is he going to some, like, ad agency that has their own studio and they record it there and then distribute it? I don't know why I'm starting the show asking you about commercial recording and distribution mechanisms, but here we are.
Well, we're trying to figure out if what our realistic chances are of getting Jay Buhner to record.
Thank you.
You know it, baby.
Oh, God. Okay, because my point is, if he's going into Cairo, the station
Jalapeno.
A mile from my house that I go to usually once every few weeks to do some work, if he's recording that in those studios, then we're really damn close to just getting a tiny piece of copy in front of his face.
Here's the thing. I'm sure that at least two or three times a year, The Bone has reason to visit the Bonneville Broadcasting Center, a.k.a. Cairo, ESPN 710, and KTTH. I'm sure he comes in there for some glad handing and for some, recording of either those spots or something else. He's also probably on the sports station a lot during baseball season.
Oh, yeah.
So the guy is around. But here's the thing, Andrew. Even if you were, let's say, filling in on the Ron and Don show, and if The Bone sauntered in to record a few things, there is no universe in which you are going to literally approach him and say, hey, would you mind just quickly recording You Know It, Baby? Like, that is not something you would do, right?
Oh, me? No. I got people to do that for me. What you do is, if he's going in, like, let's just make this more insidery. It's Russ, right? He's the production – I can't think of Russ's last name, but he's the production manager at Cairo. So chances are – I think that's his – you know, he's got that big studio office thing where people will go in and cut their, you know, rug factory spots. They're talk about the mattress wars.
You and I just spent about 45 minutes before we started recording trying to craft the perfect smoker to whiz back at one of the haters and the losers on Twitter. Somebody had tweeted at us something about, I heard about your show from Andy Kindler. By the way, Andy Kindler is a hilarious, hilarious comic.
I know, which is amazing. If you want to read it directly, I send it to your phone. I sent you a grab of the tweet.
Okay, I've got it right here. So somebody tweets at the TBTL Twitter page, Andy Kindler recommended your cast, so I listened to a random ep. Taking a battery out of your boat story, so boring. Does it improve later? So you alerted me to this tweet, and so then you were like, well, what we were kind of brainstorming on how to respond to it. And we were going to say something along the lines of, like, we thought that was actually one of the highlights of the week, which is not even a joke, actually. So we were, like, trying to figure out the perfect response that wouldn't seem too snarky or too defensive, but that would kind of, you know, be funny and also make the joke on us a little bit, etc. And in the time it took us to try to think up the response, the dude had apparently deleted the tweet. That was not an overly mean tweet. Not by the standards of
even
the ones we get sometimes.
Even for you and I, the most fragile men in podcasting. Yeah. By the way, write that down for our imaging meeting tomorrow. The most fragile men in podcasting. That could be our tagline. But you know,
tell them the most fragile men in podcasting sent you.
Tell them the most fragile men in podcasting.
Wow, you sound like Owen Meany. That's how I've always imagined Owen Meany's voice.
I think Owen would be louder. He speaks in all caps.
But so. But here's the thing. That tweet was basically calling out the fact that this show can sometimes find itself conversationally in some pretty shallow water, some pretty boring areas. And I don't think we've done anything at the top of this program to dispute the underlying premise of that tweet. So what I would say is, tweet Bahara, game recognized game, my friend. I think you nailed it. I think the show is pretty boring sometimes.
I know, and that's kind of the thing. So people who know this show well know that you and I sometimes get I'm not going to say it's random, but I understand if you're somebody who's criticizing you or me, you don't have any in maybe even a jokey way. It's like 50-50 whether or not we are going to overreact to it in some way, even privately overreact to it or possibly publicly overreact to it, which is how we came up with Hey Dummies in the first place, right? You writing back to a listener, hey dummy. but in this one, it was like that. It was kind of like, first of all, this was a tweet that he didn't tag Andy in it. He didn't at Andy. So Andy probably won't see this tweet, although – I was very happy to hear that. I knew that Andy would listen from the time to time or was listening a little bit this summer. But it sounds like not only is he listening, or at least occasionally, but he's telling people to listen, which is a huge compliment. Like, I'm a big fan. Like, that guy's really funny. And that's nice. And he's got a pretty big megaphone. So that's really cool. But I guess the bad thing is, like, one of those things where, you know, it's nice to promote something, but you want to make sure that you're backing it up with some quality content. And maybe we need to coordinate with Andy the next time he gives us a shout out, make sure that we got some really good content that we're proud of and not just, I don't know, whatever we're doing now.
I have a response to what you just said. You know it, baby.
That's mine. You can't use that.
All right, let's thank some donors of the day. Yeah, tweet Bahara, we have donors of the day. Okay. These are fine, generous folks who donated during last year's TBTL-a-thon, I should say, and also this year's TBTL-a-thon, maybe even most importantly to our bottom line, this year's TBTL-a-thon. And those recurring donations make the show possible. Travis Spokes of White Plains, New York. I believe that JetBlue used to fly out of White Plains. I think there was a period of time where if you wanted a cheap flight and to get as close to New York City as you really could, you could go to White Plains and get on JetBlue.
Back that in the was day. Like their hub, you know, or that was just like...
I just remember in a long, long time ago, like I'm talking 20 years ago, maybe it wasn't even JetBlue. It might have been Southwest. One of the budget air carriers. I remember being a young person and wanting to go to New York City, but realizing that airfare was really expensive and trying to figure out, well, where could I go that's close? Mm. And I knew somebody was flying into White Plains, New York, of all places.
Would that be Westchester County Airport in White Plains?
I guess it would be maybe, possibly. Yeah. Actually, you know, I believe Dave Ross was taking that flight for a while. Not even joking.
Cause, right, going home.
Because he hails from Westchester County. So thanks, Travis. I don't know what your whole connection to that budget airline is. I hope
good
one, and I hope it's been profitable for you. And you're now obviously redirecting some of those profits towards TBTL, and we appreciate it. Dan Zimkowak. How would you say that? I was just trying to go with leaving the S. Simcoic? Ooh, that's good. See, your chucha would be proud.
I don't think I'm getting it right, but I think I'm getting it close.
You're getting it a lot closer than I had. I rolled the dice and went with dropping the S, but I think you're right. Simcoac. I think I should have dropped the Z. I think that was
maybe
that was my critical error. Dan Simcoac of Brooklyn, New York,
where I will be there
in a matter of a few days. I'm going to New York on next Monday. I'm shooting a thing in Brooklyn about ketchup on Tuesday. And
condiments really rule everything around us these days. We had two TBTL videos in a row about condiments. You're doing a CBS piece about condiments. That's it.
You know, and for once, when we make that joke, it actually did still spell cream.
And some people use cream as a condiment. So, wow.
Dollar bill, y'all.
I feel like we need to be better.
Thanks for the dollar bill, y'all, Dan.
We need to be better for Tweet Bahara.
How about this? Jared Blank of St. Louis, France? What? Should I say, should I try to say St. Louis in a more
French how window? Would you say St. Louis?
St. Louis?
Oh, man. I think we're just making
Jared
it worse.
Jared Blank of St. Louis, France. How about that? Did that sound pretty believable?
Yeah, no, I'm very into it.
Amber Collins of Baltimore, Maryland, also supported TBTL and has been supporting TBTL. Thanks, Amber. Travis, Dan, Jared, and Amber. We could not do this show without you. So thanks for making it happen. This episode 2493 in a collector series. This is because of you guys. So thank you. I know. I'm never super stoked when randomly and on the Kim Cattrall free bass scat solo part of that song.
Yo, yo, yo.
Oh, man. Don't do it, Luke. Don't do it. Don't do it. Stop. Don't do it. Don't do it. I'm just going to quickly do this. I was watching my beloved HGTV last night, and I don't want to count anyone else's money, but I tend to gravitate towards a show called House Hunters Renovation. And it's where, a family or a couple or a person, somebody will buy a house and then they got to fix it up because it's in crummy shape when they get it. And they've been shooting a lot of them in L.A. now, and they've shoot almost all of them in Silver Lake, which is kind of right by where I used to live a long time ago. And so I'm particularly interested in it. Now, I know for the record that those shows are kind of rigged. Like usually what happens is the people have already bought a particular house, and then they make them go fake look at other houses so they can have this illusion of like, oh, they're debating between these three. But from a practical standpoint, it would never work if that was literally the show, because you'd be getting outbid on half of the houses and it'd take months just to get all the, escrow stuff worked out. So I was watching the one. What blows me away is that people, their budget of house they can buy based on their jobs. There was a couple, I want to say the husband was a aspiring puppeteer, and I think that their budget was somewhere north of $750,000. Last night's was the modest budget of $500,000, half of $1 million of house buying budget, and the wife was a nurse, and the husband was a freelance upright bass player. Basically a lot of this. I wasn't trying to start that part of the song. I thought we were still going to be in the free bass jam jazz section of the. But you get the idea.
Sure.
And it was like, the guy wasn't a bad dude at all, but I was like, I don't understand the economics of a freelance upright bass player having a budget of $500,000 to spend on a house. Again, you might be great at it, but it's just like, that just seems like. That being a freelance jazz bass player seems like you're taking a vow of renting. you are not gonna be getting in the home ownership game in Los Angeles anytime soon.
For better or for worse, or for security deposit.
Yeah, you're taking a vow of renting. And seriously, like peace and love. That's why I said to myself,
peace and love, peace and love.
So I said, like, don't go there because who cares? I'm not trying to be critical of the man's chosen profession and of his art. I just am, again, I'm always blown away at how much house people can apparently get when some of them have jobs that I just don't traditionally think of as being that lucrative.
Can I ask you, are you surprised that there's still houses available for just $500K in Silver Lake? I know back in the day that would make sense, but like Silver Lake is where like all the celebs are moving. Like it's, you know, Tony now. Or like hip,
yeah, well,
hipster Tony.
So this is where this is how I'm a crazy person. I will, as if like this is the, now I'm going to finally let the listeners know. The previous 2,492 episodes don't stand as a monument to my problems, interpersonal and intrapersonal. But I will sometimes try to stalk the people on that show. Like I'll try to figure out enough details about them that I can see if I can find what their real life is, like where they work. Or one of them was an aspiring comedian, and he and his wife were buying like an $800,000 house, and I was like, it does not compute. So then I was trying to find like if the guy had representation, if there was tape of him performing comedy. Like, so I'll try to piece together based on their first names.
Because what's the difference between an aspiring comedian and a comedian? You know, like where is that cutoff? Have you had that conversation before? Am I just actually quoting you talking to a comedian on TBTL?
Not that I remember.
Because that's kind of an interesting thing, right? At what point are you an aspiring comedian? At what point is it like when you can, I guess when X percent of your income is coming in from your comedy?
Well, for instance, you're not an aspiring comedian because you don't go to open mics. You're not writing stand-up comedy material. You're not trying to hone your craft, right? And you're making $0 off of your comedy. But there are other people who are aspiring comedians who are like doing all of those things. They're maybe working on their act. They're writing jokes down. They're going to open mics. They're also making $0, but they are an aspiring comedian, mm-hmm. right? Would that be a
categorize
things?
Yeah, so that totally makes sense. Like you're definitely aspiring if you're not making any bank off of it. But it seems like probably like a lot of the – and I'm not asking. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just kind of curious because at a certain point, like if you're making some money off of your comedy, but you're not like a regular writer for a show or something, you know, like, or you're not, you know, 100% of your income isn't coming from you touring and selling tickets for your comedy. It's kind of like at what point, because it just seems like we've talked to a lot of comedians on this show, and it seems like, you know, when we were talking to Funches, no, he was already opening for some pretty big names. I was thinking about Funches today and the time he was on the show. So he would have been just a comedian then, but he was definitely a struggling comedian. I remember him just like talking about how hard it is. And I think he was like, not sure. I don't know where to live or what to pursue. Am I mischaracterizing that interview? Do you remember? I remember him being just like, wow, yeah, I don't know.
I think I remember that. Yeah, I think I remember that being the tone of the conversation.
That was years ago. And of course, now he's a pretty big name. So anyway,
he's on an NBC show and everything.
I derailed you though. Anyway.
No, but what I do though, back to your question of if somebody could get a home in Silver Lake for $500,000, what I will do then is I'll try to, if I can, deduce where the actual house is that they bought. And it's really hard because the producers of the show explicitly don't want you as the viewer to kind of know where the people live. But I will sometimes be able to catch a street sign in the background or some other kind of clue that I can try to use. Now, in this particular case, I wasn't able to figure out where the people live, but I will tell you this. It probably wasn't Silver Lake. Think about the things – because they didn't quite call it Silver Lake. They said near their target area of Silver Lake. Well, now this is the part of the show where we just deep dive on Los Angeles geography. It could very easily be on the other side of the 101 where things are quite different than Silver Lake. And you don't really have a frame of reference. I do know that show plays really fast and loose with neighborhoods though, because they'll be like their target area is Silver Lake. But their agent wants them to see how much more they can get for their money. So he's taking them to the nearby town of Temecula. Like, yeah, that's in the desert. That's 200 miles away. That's not, you know, or like literally last night it was they wanted to be in Silver Lake. And the real estate agent took them to Downey,
I don't know where
which
Downey
is like
is.
Downey is down by Disneyland, basically, I think. I know it's like south. And then took them to somewhere else that was like
way out in the, like, not in Los Angeles, like in the valley somewhere, like way, way out in the valley, the San Fernando Valley. So because most people watching the show don't actually live, haven't lived in LA, to them it all seems like, oh yeah, well, that's a beautiful house and it's only 15 miles from their target area. But it's like, that's a long 15 miles if you're talking about LA.
I'm looking at a map of LA now, just kind of, because I always got confused where Los Feliz and Echo Park are in relation to Silver Lake. Even when I was living there, I always had to like kind of like plot it out. I'm just plotting it out. And you said you crossed the 101. Well, you crossed the 101, you're getting kind of into my old neighborhood. And I'm having feels. Like, it doesn't happen often. Like, when I was in LA, I spent a lot of time not trying to dwell or be moody about it, but I spent a lot of time missing Seattle and thinking about Seattle places I wish I were, et cetera. I don't, you know, I've always said there are
definitely chicken fried steaks you wished you were eating.
Yes, there are definitely times and parts of LA where I'm like, oh, it would be nice to go to whatever, this restaurant I like called Home or what have you, or that place in the Frolic Room in Hollywood. But now I'm just like looking at the neighborhood and I'm kind of getting sucked into this. This probably isn't good podcasting, but again, everything's cut outable, just like yours. What did you want me to cut out before? Oh, when you were just trashing.
The previous 30 minutes and 52 seconds.
When you were just calling a Fatwan the Wilcox Farms girl. Like, I don't even get it. I'm having real feels. I'm like looking around my old neighborhood on Google Maps here. I'm looking at Ye Olde Rustic Inn in Silver Lake and remembering fantastic bingo nights that I had there and mostly remember. Maybe I should move back to L.A.
Well, all you got to do is get your freelance jazz bass career off the ground.
I'm an aspiring
half of $1 million to buy a house somewhere in Silver Lake adjacent.
I am an aspiring freelance stand-up bassist.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
Can you do me a favor and write down aspiring
yes
freelance stand-up bassist as
yes,
a possible
I
show
will.
Title.
I will do that. Take a note.
Let's talk about Lulu the bomb sniffing dog. Now, the CIA of all organizations took to Twitter recently and started tweeting out from the official CIA account at CIA the story of Lulu the dog. And I guess Lulu the dog, who is an adorable, adorable little, like, black lab, I guess. Maybe a mix of some kind of lab and something else. But primarily, it looks like a lab. Lulu, apparently, was being trained to be an explosive sniffing dog. But Lulu, after testing really well early on, which is how she was selected, started to lose interest in bomb sniffing. This is all according to a series of tweets by the CIA from their official account. It starts with the CIA saying, sometimes even after testing, our pups make it clear that being an explosive detection canine isn't for them. And there's a picture of Lulu. And then it says another tweet, Lulu was adopted by her handler and now enjoys her days playing with his kids and a new friend and sniffing out rabbits and squirrels by the backyard. Mm. This is after Lulu was... Now, here's the thing. Was she fired or did she retire? Because the CIA also says, we'll miss Lulu, but it was the right decision for her, and we wish her all the best in her new life. There was a series of tweets about kind of the training of these dogs and when it's decided if the dogs should stick in the program or not, and how some dogs lose interest for a few days, but it's only temporary, and then they get back into it. There was another tweet from the CIA talking about how their dog handlers become kind of like amateur doggy psychologists trying to figure out why a dog is not showing interest in the bomb sniffing task. What I thought was kind of interesting too was that depending on the newspaper that you were reading, some of them were describing it as being so that the New York Post wrote a headline that said Lulu was fired. The Washington Post headline was that Lulu flunks out. But then the Independent in the UK was much softer. They said Lulu was retired by the CIA. Which I thought was nice. I like that they let Lulu have her dignity. But the question to me is, did Lulu retire? Did she walk away from the bomb sniffing game, or did the CIA fire her for not being good at bomb sniffing?
Well, Not to make a thing out of everything. I think there's some sort of scandal going on here, though, because I read a statement from Lulu saying that she wants to spend more time with her family.
With her crotch?
She said she's
just thinking about what my dog wants to spend time with.
She said she wants to spend more time with her crotch, which actually maybe that's the scandal. Maybe that's the scandal right there now that I think of it. Well, I don't think that dogs can make up their own decisions on how they're going to spend all of their time. So I assume if she's not performing up to the task, then they had to pull her, right? But I mean, it doesn't mean she's not happy that they pulled her, because she probably is happy.
I think it's an interesting, it's a very clever PR coup by the CIA, right?
Ooh, another coup by the CIA. Great.
Jesus. I really walked into that one, didn't I? It was not what I was trying to play. Trying to play something more like this. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about how those words were going to sound when I said them out loud. I think that it was a savvy PR decision by the CIA, though, to tweet about this, because they must have hundreds of dogs that come through this program, and there must be a good number of them that just aren't up to the task or lose interest or don't work for some reason, maybe from temperament or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason on earth that the CIA needed to alert the wider world that Lulu the dog was walking away from the game. Like, nobody would have known about it. But the CIA's, their social media team.
Sorry.
The CIA social media team very smartly identified this as, I guess, a good way to generate some attention, raising another question. If you're the CIA, do you want more attention on social media? Is that really something you should be going for as the CIA?
I think you want people to have citizens of the United States to have a good feeling about the CIA. And so this probably, you know, this is exactly why, you know, obviously there were no social media managers 30 years ago. So this is all kind of new. But yeah, I think that's where the social media people kind of earn their keep a bit, right? Like, I don't know. Can you draw a direct line between the response that this story is getting and any actual benefit to the CIA? Hard to say. But generally speaking, and again, I think the CIA... One thing they have been doing for years is trying to influence the way people think, and I guess social media is just a new part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think this is a big win for whoever is in charge of the Twitter feed for the CIA, because it's gone from being – they basically materialized a story.
Mm-hmm. Out of
whole cloth. I mean, this was not a thing, and they said, hey, we're going to put a bunch of pictures of an adorable dog up, and we're going to take people through the process of how a dog basically, like, I like the idea, by the way, that when Lulu leaves the CIA, it's one of those classic kind of like cop movie tropes where they have to like take away her, like, what would her stuff be? Like, take away her flea collar and then take away her other flea collar she wears around her ankle.
I'm going to go to bone again. I think I'm going to need your collar and your bone.
I guess. I feel like bone's a little on the nose.
Classic. I consider it classic. Classic comedy with K's.
That's what we're known for. This picture of Matthew McConaughey pep-talking the University of Texas men's basketball team has gone all over the internet. He was at a team practice on Tuesday, and he's standing talking to them, and he's got his right hip kind of popped out, and it's sort of a power pose. And somebody noticed this and then retweeted it, a guy who happened to be a University of Texas graduate. Put the caption, "I don't know what McConaughey was saying, but it must have been fierce AF." And the message went viral. The tweet has been liked 100,000 times. It's been retweeted 31,000 times. A couple things here. One, we've played tape of Matthew McConaughey talking to the University of Texas football team.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, if I remember right, it was absolutely unintelligible. Like,
do you want to hear it? I actually saved it.
You still have it?
Yeah, I actually saved that.
Will you play a little bit just for... Presumably, he's giving a similar speech to the basketball team. I mean, it's just kind of it's your standard stock Matthew McConaughey pump them up speech. But if I remember the football team one right, it felt like it was a little all over the map to me.
Yes. I got a 2 minute and 31 second version and a 1 minute six. Let's just go with the long one if we're trying to prove the point that this was all over the place.
I'll say this. I've found that when I've done my best work, it was only when I pushed myself to be better than I even thought I could be. And I got a pretty high idea of how good I can be. I'm pretty self-confident with how good I can be. But I didn't do my best work, and I still don't think I've done my best work until I push myself further than even I think I can be. But it's amazing how easy the mind can go up and down, man. So I guess what I'm saying is, again, ask yourself, why are you playing the game? And in there, you're going to find the answer of why you play it, whether you win or whether you lose. Because when you do well, you feel it, and you can look in the mirror and you go, that's right, I earned that, I did that. And you lay your head down a pillow at night, and you gave it all, and you busted your ass, and you anticipated that pass, wherever it was as a cornerback, and you picked it. Oh, but you were that close to holding back, or whatever that is, that play where you were just a little quicker. You know at the end of the day when you lie your head on your pillow, I knew it. I knew it. Because I made that play. And if everybody's everyone's looked themselves.
First of all, none of that makes sense. Second of all, this is the one time in human history when someone used lie instead of lay. People often use lay when they mean lie.
Oh yeah.
Like you don't like because to lay is to place something down, right? So you don't lie your head on your pillow, right? You lay your head on your pillow. Your head is placed upon your pillow. But he said you lie your head on your pillow.
But isn't it now I lay me down to sleep? Is that just wrong?
No, because I think you could lay yourself down to sleep. You couldn't lie yourself down to sleep, but you could be lying there.
Oh.
You could not be laying there, but you could be lying there, right?
Honestly,
I don't feel like
this
I'm
is
taking
one
this story to where the most interesting part of it is. That's for sure.
Are you selling the sizzle, as you like to say? All right, I won't go north down that road because I don't know. I don't have answers to that. That's as nitpicky as I am about certain things. I will say that I think if I'm writing it in a context where it actually matters in some sort of professional way, I will probably just look it up every time, and I will probably die never really having a good grasp on that.
So yeah, that's kind of. I mean, who – I don't – like I understand Matthew McConaughey is famous, but I don't really understand who – if it was his idea or someone else's that he should be pep-talking these teams because I just don't feel like anything he said there really makes logical – or it doesn't really connect up conceptually. Like I feel like maybe he should show up and shake some hands and maybe say all right and just like kind of like – be a fun mascot for the team. But as far as like getting inside the head of a cornerback for the University of Texas football team and giving him that little extra motivation to intercept the football, it just seems unlikely that this is going to have the desired effect.
I like the idea of just having him straight up be a mascot, like actually name a team like the University of Texas McConaughey's. And then you like, and then you have like a mascot, somebody dresses up like a big foam McConaughey, and they go around kind of doing just like gesticulating, pumping the crowd up. All right. I love that idea a lot. As far as him actually doing what he's doing, I mean, as he says, he's got a pretty high opinion of himself. I'm sure, you know, he's obviously a huge, you know, he prides his connection to the Texas culture, which is kind of cool. I really like that. McConaughey has just gotten to that point where I just can't take it anymore. Even when we played this football tape, this would have been like 3 or 4 years ago. Because I remember agonizing about trying to figure out if I could actually turn it into intro tape, but it's not really funny. It's just cringy. You know what I mean?
The thing about McConaughey, I think that's why it's hard for somebody like me and maybe you, Andrew, to sort of, I don't want to say tolerate. Here's the confusing thing about McConaughey is that he's just sort of like the guy making like the movie Ed TV. Like he was just kind of an actory dude and whatever. But then he made his way into these films like, or I guess I should say a TV show like True Detective and some pretty serious films like Dallas Buyers Club, right? He's in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, that's him. I've never seen that, although I heard it's great. Like, I should really watch it.
He kind of had this like Texas bro-y film career going, and then all of a sudden he pops up in these really serious things, and he's pretty convincing. Like, he's a compelling actor to watch.
Yeah.
But he's sort of like, I think I was like, oh yeah, it's the all right guy. Now I'm like, oh wait, no, he's time is a flat circle guy. And to me, it's sort of like, but then you see him just like jogging in Santa Monica with his shirt off and his beautiful flowing mane of hair, which I know I already said this to you before we started the show, but much in the fashion of Larry Flint putting out a, I think, $10 million reward for any dirt on Donald Trump, I am right now putting out a $10 million reward for whoever can figure out who did Matthew McConaughey's hair transplant, because I want to go to there.
Now, how do you know about this? How do you know? You're a man who looks at other men's hair more than I do. How did you, have you seen his hair recede and then come back? Or is there something about the texture of his hair?
Please do me a favor and put the words Ed TV into internet and then hit images and then now I'm going to just try to point you towards a specific photo. Okay, actually, no. Here. Here's a better example. Okay. Do this. And good luck spelling McConaughey upon first try. But do McConaughey mug shot. Type that in. Type in McConaughey mug shot.
Okay. I'm going to go with their suggested spelling of McConaughey.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It is oh, wow. Yeah. What did he do?
He got the world's greatest hair transplant, and
no,
I want to know his
secret. Why does he have a mugshot?
Trying to sneak into Mexico for an illegal hair transplant? I don't know.
Law enforcement, what did he do? McConaughey.
Oh, you know what he was doing? He was playing bongo drums naked. How do you not know this story? It's like,
oh, he actually,
like
I knew he did that. He got arrested for that?
I think that they called, well, actually, no, you know what? I'm sorry. I know the police were called on him once because he was playing naked bongo drums. But I'm also, I want to send you this other picture of
but yeah,
McConaughey
he's
before
definitely
he got his procedure. Yeah. I don't know how he did it, but he has cracked the code on painting your bald spot. Like, and I don't think he's painted it. I think he just got like, maybe it's just like
sick.
A series of transplants, but it's so, it looks good. It's not like, there are people who get hair transplants and it's still kind of, it doesn't look natural or normal. He is not one of them, man. He looks amazing these days.
Can I give you some background from The Smoking Gun on this? One of my favorite websites. This is underneath his
about the hair transplant?
Well, I'm going to talk first about his arrest. McConaughey was arrested by Austin police October 1999. So this is going on 20 years ago. You're right. He has way less hair. This is exactly what they're talking about in Paint Your Bald Spot, that whole the whole spoof of the Larry King. They're saying you used to have less hair. October 1999, and charged with possession of marijuana and drug paraphernalia after a neighbor called to complain about music blaring from the actor's crib. Oh, come on, Smoking Gun. Don't say crib. Don't try to be cool.
You paint your bald spot?
What bald spot?
Anyway, so that's interesting. So that was not from the Nick. He didn't get arrested for public nudity. But yeah, you're absolutely right about that hair transplant. You're right.
So and listen, tip of the cap. The cap I'm wearing because I don't want people to know how bald I am.
Right.
That is it's amazing work. I've never seen anything like it. And I've spent hours late at night on the internet trying to get to the bottom of what kind of Faustian bargain that man made, because I would make the same bargain in a New York minute. Anyway, back to power posing. When I read this article, first of all, I did think extensively about Matthew McConaughey's luxurious hair and how jealous I am. But then I also was thinking about the term power posing, because there was just a really interesting article in the New York Times Magazine over the weekend about power, the person who is kind of credited with identifying what sort of the benefits of quote-unquote power posing are, and also the way that social science is kind of evolving in terms of what social science research we believe and don't believe. The woman is named Amy Cuddy, and she was a part of a duo that was kind of – that basically did some research, and they found that if you were to stand – in a quote-unquote power position. So like standing with your hands, like your fist balled up and your hands on your hips, kind of think about like what Superman or Wonder Woman might do.
I'm doing it
If you did
now.
That for a certain period of time, you would then feel bolder, you would be more willing to take risk, and you would basically be a more powerful person. They did a study where they basically told people that they were being hooked up to an electrocardiogram for some other reason, so like kind of a heart monitor they strap around your chest. And they had half of the people stand in what they consider to be a power pose. So they put them in a certain position. And then they had the other half not stand in that position. And afterwards, they found, at least in their research, that the people who'd been in the power pose were feeling more powerful and were more likely to take a risk. I think they had them do some sort of exercise with dice and gambling. And so this research got published by this woman, Amy Cuddy, and her partner, and it was a sensation. This was also around the same time when, like, TED Talks were just starting, and so she recorded a TED Talk about power posing, and it became, I think to this day, it's like the second most watched TED Talk ever. And it just – it very neatly fit in with this idea of, particularly as it pertains to women, the idea of just kind of, you know – I guess sort of being more powerful in the world and not being – not allowing a lot of societal prejudice and misogyny to sort of you know, beat you down and make you feel small. That there was a way – and again, it's not just for women. It could be for anybody. But there's a way that if you're somebody who hasn't historically felt powerful, if you do this thing, it's going to actually trick your body into feeling powerful and you're going to be able to, you know, be more assertive, et cetera. Well, this article in the New York Times Magazine by Susan Dominus is amazing, because what it really gets into is the fact that what's happened with social science over the course of the last few years is that the in-style thing now is not even so much to come up with research that is cutting edge. I mean, of course, if you can come up with cutting edge research, that's great too. That'll help build your brand. But the real thing that people want to do now, it seems, is take existing research that's been done and figure out why that research is not legit. And it's called replicating. And it's a whole – it's a way that you can make your name in this kind of particular social science is by finding somebody else's groundbreaking thing and then replicating it and then not being able to reproduce the results and then putting that out so as to kind of put the other research on blast and make your own name. You're kind of like a myth buster of other social science research. And a big part of it comes down to something that I don't totally understand called p-hacking. Basically, there's a certain, like, probability in these studies. The probability of something happening, and the lower the probability of the research happening, of the outcome you got happening, the more legit your research is. But what's happened over time, and again, this is me trying to interpret what I'm reading in the New York Times. We have lots of listeners who are actually social scientists, so somebody will send us a detailed description. But basically what seems to have been happening for a good amount of time, particularly with this kind of research, is people kind of throwing out stuff that doesn't help the research, doesn't help them come up with an interesting result. And also just kind of just tweaking certain things, not in such a way that they're lying, but just cherry picking certain data and doing this and doing this thing called p-hacking, where you get a more interesting result than you might otherwise get. And a couple of people from the same program that Amy Cuddy were in, a couple of guys, instead of becoming the great researchers of their time, they seem to have become the great research debunkers of their time. And so they kind of went I don't think it was intended to be personally hurtful, but they sort of ended up writing these blog posts about how this power pose research was really not very reliable. And it's sort of, in a way, it's kind of ruined Amy Cuddy's academic cred. Now, the good news, I guess, for her, good news in quotes, depending on what her life goals are, which I don't really know, is that she managed to leverage this TED Talk into a best-selling book. She gets paid tons of money to show up and talk at places. She's a very well-paid speaker. She was, by the way, on a tenure track at Harvard as a professor. She's now left that position. It's not clear if that's because her academic stuff is seen as less than reliable. I mean, she's taken this and she's leveraged it into a whole career as being like the power pose, you know, the professional power pose speaker. And so she's in demand. So she's, I guess, okay. But her academic stuff is not necessarily as well regarded as it was at one time. I guess I just thought this was interesting because it feels – I can't think of a good analogy, but it feels very 2017 that the one of the ways to make your mark now is by basically just like pointing out how someone else's stuff isn't as good as they thought it was.
Like covering a song but doing a really shitty version of it and saying you should have never written this in the first place.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's a great analogy. That's kind of that feels a little bit like, I mean, on the other hand,
yeah, they're not doing, I want to make it clear, I don't think they're doing a shitty job. And in reality, they're it's probably good, right? Because it leads to more rigorous research, dotting I's, crossing T's. And
I guess, but I mean, yes, I think it probably ultimately is a good thing. But it's sort of like, I don't know, I don't want to sound too negative about the people who are doing the replications, but it does seem a little bit like a, well, you couldn't come up with something interesting and novel, so what you figured out how to do is tear something else down. Now, I guess if the other something wasn't reliable, then it should be torn down. Mm-hmm. One of the projects that these guys that are kind of sort of leading this crusade, I guess, to have more rigorous research, one of the things they came up with was they asked 20 participants their ages, and half of the group was listening to the Beatles song When I'm 64, and the other part of the group listened to a control song, an instrumental song called Kalimba. And using the standard methodology, like the current methodology that all of these people, including Amy Cuddy, are using, they were able to prove that participants who listened to the Beatles song were magically a year and a half younger than they were before they had heard the music.
They convinced them that?
What they were able to do is take, under the standard methodology, in other words, under the rules of doing this kind of research, because the rules are kind of funky, and because if you leave certain things out, if you highlight certain information,
oh, this
and
is
you
what
omit
the
certain information.
Oh, gotcha. This is what the debunkers did to prove that. I see. Sorry, I got lost there for a second. Right.
Yeah. So the debunkers basically set up this project to prove how BS the standard methodology.
Interesting.
And by using the standard methodology, they were able to. They were able to find that people who were listening to the song When I'm 64 by the Beatles were a year and a half younger after they had heard the song, based on asking people to report their ages, based on the music they were listening to, based on the control, and just based on futzing with the numbers in a completely allowable way, if that makes sense. The idea being that if you're using the standard methodology, you can create almost any outcome you want, or at least you can create a lot of interesting outcomes that make no sense on paper, but work based on what the sort of formula for what you can include and not include is.
Which is why I think this is a good thing. And I'm just worried now. I'm kind of in my head. I don't know if Tweet Bahara, if we've lost him or not, if we're taking this to Boring Town. But Tweet Bahara, if you're still listening, we're going to get back to the funny real soon here. But the reason I think it's a good thing is because we do also live in an age of a lot of – it's kind of cool that people are sort of into science more than ever before, that there's, you know, all kinds of pop science all around us. Pop scientists are celebrities. We have, because of what's going on with the administration and climate change deniers, we have people actually marching in the streets to stand up and defend the merits of science, which is insane. I mean, science is having a real heyday in a certain way. It's also, I mean, in certain circles, I guess. But there is a problem, and you know, our scientist listeners will often email us, and you see it all over the place. Like, there's just so much bullshit. I mean, you listen to any episode of On the Media, they're going to be probably talking about some bullshit science story that, you know, made it all the way to all of the network morning shows on television, even though it's just like, I don't know, it's like, oh, this week chocolate will prevent heart attacks, then chocolate will prevent cancer, and then, you know, and all this stuff. And there's just so much of that I'm, you know, I'm glad there's a bunch of people out there doing bad cover versions of these scientific studies.
And this article, she's certainly not overtly trying to diss Malcolm Gladwell, but she sort of talks about the way that Malcolm Gladwell also came in with Blink at exactly this moment when there's all this social science research going on, but then Malcolm Gladwell's great at the storytelling side of it. So he can take this, you know, I would say some of it's probably pretty good science and some of it maybe isn't the greatest science, just generally speaking. But then he can spin it into this very digestible narrative and life lesson. And that's why, like, his work has, I mean, he's also, I think, super talented and interesting, by the way. But it is kind of, and you know, who's the guy that you knew who kind of ran into so much trouble? Jonah Lehrer.
Jonah, yeah.
like was part of this world. There's this intersection of like science and this American life, you know,
yeah,
if you will, of like these great stories about why we do what we do because of the research. And yet, if you look back at the research, it would appear anyway, if these other guys are to be believed in this article, a lot of that research using standard methodology may not be as solid as we once thought it was. And there's money in it. Part of why this Amy Cuddy woman, who sounds like a perfectly nice and a perfectly intelligent human being. I mean, the point of this article is not really that she sucks. The point of this article is that it's a weird time to be doing this kind of research mm-hmm. because of this kind of now people going back and really looking at everything and there being a certain kind of – it's like winning on the internet if you can just find the way that somebody was being a racist or being a misogynist or being – like there's kind of a value in holding up this thing and saying, when you said this, it was not okay because of this. It's like these scientists saying, when you found this research, it was not okay because of this. It's a whole kind of cottage industry. And this woman this woman Amy Cuddy kind of got swept up in all of it. But the TED Talk thing too is hugely part of this, because we are like, as a society, I think we're like so hungry for information about how to make our life better, about how to be smarter, how to be more efficient, how to love better, how to bounce back from things. And this whole kind of TED Talkification of the US, or at least of a certain like sector of the US, is a really interesting phenomenon. We're all like trying to get way smarter, and there's a lot more research out there about things that previously would have probably been seen as unquantifiable or squishy or not really the stuff of science. Like, it's not chemistry, it's not physics, it's not these kind of hard science. It's more social science. It's more like, well, why do people feel that way when they walk into this kind of room type of thing?
Can I jump in here and do my own little science project? I've always wanted to do this. The professor is under my desk right now on the chair across from me, and she's snoring. And I want to see if I can get the microphone close to her.
Let me just clarify for Tweet Bahar or any first-time listeners. The professor is a professor that lives at Andrew and Genevieve's house.
Okay, here's Professor Banana snoring. Can you hear that?
Yes, that's amazing. That may have redeemed this entire episode.
Sometimes it took me – I remember she did this a while back, and I couldn't figure out what the noise was during the show.
I
want to
hear more.
Let me see if I can get this again. Yeah. Okay. We are a house of snorers, my
That's
friend.
So cute.
There a cat is something. Is an angel that poops in a box.
That is the cutest thing I've ever heard
life. I love it when she hangs out in here with me. She, it's kind of like, I don't know, 50-50. Sometimes she just like, she'll go a couple of weeks without wanting to be in here at all. And you can't really like, can't tell where the professor, you can't tell her where to be, right? Professor's going to profess wherever she is. And then she'll go through a couple of weeks where she just wants to be in here podcasting with me all the time. And it looks like I got one of those weeks. But I'll tell you what.
Have you gone back, though, and double-checked any of her research papers? Because
yeah,
it's very possible that the methodology she was using was not reliable.
You know, yeah. You kind of know about this, right? That paper she did that 100% of Theos taste good when you lick them.
If you're in a power pose?
Well, turns out she was using a very small sample size, and that is how she ended up.
No one's ever called Theo very small before.
By the way, for new listeners, Theo is also a professor who lives with me. All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now, but have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email every week. I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man. It's not from a female.
All right. Emails? V-mails?
Yes.
Any of the above? Or do we just play some cat power and get out of here?
I got a bunch of stuff that I want. Oh, cat power. Are we going to play I Lived in Bars? That's your... Is that both of ours favorite cat power song?
Yeah, probably that's my go-to. Yeah. I mean, I like a lot of her music, actually, but I am a particular fan of that song.
I have three emails today. I forgot to check the voicemail line. I'll check that tomorrow, but I don't know why I had to tell you that. Maybe people think we just don't have voicemails, but nope, I didn't do my job. Sorry. A couple of things that I'm excited about. One, we got an email from Anne that I'm not going to read it verbatim, but it did make me wonder if you and I were talking about eating treats at work and how you and I don't go into that culture of like, hey, I brought in some homemade brownies or whatever, and then everybody gets together and kind of gabs. I mean, it's your classic water cooler kind of situation. And you and I started by saying we don't really go in for that. And I don't know, we might have gotten a little bit cruel. I was like, oh, yeah, is it the HR lady who brings it in? I don't know if we were kind of stereotyping.
Yeah, maybe.
I think I'm the one who started to say that. So that was kind of crappy. And Anne wrote in just said a couple of points here. She bullet pointed this. She said, I always bring stuff into the office. I bake a new recipe every weekend, and I bring it in to share on Monday. And this is where she wrote, by the way, I'm not a receptionist or an HR lady. I'm a statistician. And that was kind of like, oh, man, yeah, I didn't mean to like stereotype. I think that our point wasn't that people shouldn't do this. I think our point was that you and I are kind of the kind of assholes. Like, we're the ones who, like, I just kind of avoid that. I know I told a story on the show one time about, you know, when I was at KCRW, and that place is, I mean, they're just stacking desks upon desks now to find room for new employees. They're still in their old building, and there's just like nowhere really to escape. Everybody's on top of everybody there. But somebody was like, oh, it's 5 minutes till Gary's birthday. I think it was my boss. And, you know, I like my old boss, but I do not like singing happy birthday in a workplace or whatever. So like, I grabbed my friend Monica and I was just like, quick, back to the Studio C. And we just like hightailed it. I don't think that she's as much of a curmudgeon as I am, but like, I just like, I have actively like hid during office parties to not be a part of it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm doing it right and the people who are bringing in the treats at work are doing it wrong. And I apologize if I sounded snotty about that. And I think I probably was by maybe mentioning like HR lady. So I apologize. Yeah, no, I think that people who do it are, first of all, the people who are bringing it in are super nice to do so. Anne goes on to say, she loves to bake, but she's single. She lives alone. So I can't have random pans of brownies hanging around the house. That would be a bad scene, man, she says. So I totally get it. And I just wanted to personally apologize if I was being a little snotty about that. I think I am the one with the problem.
I'll join you, too, if I was sounding dismissive of the action of making delicious food and bringing it in for people. That's great. And I hope the listener, Anne.
I think.
I hope listener Anne continues to do that because I'm sure it brings joy into the lives of so many people. I'm surprised because I'm a person who really enjoys myself in a lot of different ways. Like, I like to eat. I like to drink. I indulge. I am not somebody who withholds as it relates to my enjoyment on things. But for whatever reason, I am not personally spoken to by a plate of homemade treats.
Yes.
And so I was just noting it as a surprise in my own mind because, again, I'm the kind of person who gives themselves every indulgence typically. That was not a comment on whether or not other people are enjoying it or whether or not it's a good thing to do. I think it's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is actually a great thing to do.
And yeah, and I definitely think that remembering now, kind of how I framed it, I could see how that came off as very snotty. So no excuses, just apologies. And good points. Thanks for writing in. And let's see here. I also I'm very excited about this, but I'm also a little nervous about this. Remember I told you I listen to a show that is called the Cleveland Browns Daily. It's a podcast. I believe it also airs on a radio station. It used to air on the Cleveland sports radio station that I used to kind of stream somewhat regularly. And I didn't like it at first, given a lot of detail here. I didn't like it at first because it is a it is produced by the Cleveland Browns, I believe. I'm pretty sure it is actually a Cleveland Browns product. So I was worried that the host of the show...
Are they on their 75th host in the last four seasons?
I thought it was the longest running co-host of TBTL joke, but nope. It was a joke about the Cleveland Browns. The Cleveland Browns are now 1-22, I want to say, for the past two seasons. Anyway, point is, I've been listening to this show a lot now, and even if it is a production of the Cleveland Browns, these two hosts are, as any good Browns fan or anybody who gets paid to follow the Browns, they are frustrated. They're smart in breaking down the Browns. They don't seem to be pulling their punches at all. I've really been enjoying the show this year. All of that is to say, I mentioned that they play some sort of a Browns rock rap thing at the beginning.
Oh yeah, that you said you legitimately like.
I thought I did. This, when I play this for you, so this came from
Turn Down Duke.
Mia in Painesville, Ohio. I am a Cleveland 10. I just finished listening to Monday's No Point. Here's this song. I think the first time they played it, I tried to tweet it to you, but that was a long time ago. A local artist named Mecca Don, and the song is called Rock for My Browns, and they used it as comeback music after commercial breaks. And this year, it's their theme song on this podcast. So you're going to laugh. You're going to make fun. Here's the song. Right. Listen, if nothing else, you got to admit, it's a very powerful, energetic way to start a show. There's barking. So I'm going to stop it here for a second. That's as much as I've ever heard, because then they fade underneath it and they start talking. And I didn't realize there were these lyrics.
The go, ready to roll. See us becoming, we kicking the go. Ready for y'all, ready to ball. Not on my team, we gon' get along. Orange and brown, running the town. AFC champs, I'm loving the sound. Ready for steel, ready to rave. Ready for fall, ready to bang. See us, we coming, we styling, we lock. We passing, we running, we touching it down. Cleveland, the city, we good, we did it. We been through the gritty, we loving the brown. Never will chill, never will lounge. We are the dogs, we are the hounds. Never defeat us, we blew or we bleeding. So get on your feet, cause we are the brown. I'm down,
rock for my brown. I mean, it's definitely a pump you up. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cleveland! This is for you!
I think it's really hard to make a song about a sports team that isn't super corny.
I will say that the fact that they're one win and 22 losses, it does make the kind of swagger of the song feel a little...
Well, hold them
like
more.
A little off.
Don't you think it should be like some just... sad bastard with an acoustic guitar. Don't you think that everybody involved in this song, if you just got like 11 of them and put them on a field, they'd probably get some shit done? Like, do you think that the Browns should maybe draft Mecca Don?
Absolutely.
I guess this you don't have be to more draft like them.
This is more the appropriate hype song for a 1-22 football team.
It's pleasant, though.
I mean, maybe that's a problem. Maybe they are some peace-loving Yusuf Islam types.
Yeah.
Who are just kind of like, they don't have enough. What's the band called? What's DJ Mecca Don?
Mecca Don, yeah.
They've got too much Cat Stevens and not enough Mecca Don.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. Yeah. Are they pumping themselves up with Cat Stevens at practice every week?
But never, 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 never. I never wanted water once.
That's the other problem. They're dehydrated. look, Kaiser's going out with migraines. What's the number one thing that will cause a migraine is probably being dehydrated.
Oh, my God. Now we're getting to it. This is actually – I'm glad we
had
this conversation.
So is the point of this email segment for you to just basically – officially retract multiple things, retract your comment about workplace brownies, retract your love of Mechadon's Cleveland Browns radio hype theme.
The problem is I'm not... No, the problem is I'm not retracting my love of it. I just
I'm
supremely uncool. But and it goes against everything that I should like. But I gotta say, I still think that they should continue to use this as their theme song because it is a very powerful way to start a show about the Browns. I mean, that barking kind of gets to me a little bit. And I don't even bark when we're at the Browns when we're at the Browns bar and people go either woo woo woo, you know, or woof woof woof, or whatever the hell they're doing. I think it was the first day I dragged Genevieve to a Browns bar. This was in LA a few years ago, and they started that woofing chant thing. And V's kind of looked at me or something. I'm like, I'm a huge fan, but I won't do that. And it wasn't a meatloaf joke. It was just me being honest. Like, I won't go that far or something. And she's like, so let me get this straight. You're a huge fan, but you draw the line at rooting vocally for your team, which I guess is kind of a fair point.
Are you willing to say that you are fine with the Mechadon song replacing Brown and Orange?
Oh, this one
by Dirt
really
as the official Cleveland Browns club banger. About. It's the Cleveland Browns last team in the league. Hit you so hard, never make you bleed. Coming at your heart with all the tools, making other teams. This is some real Lincoln Biscuit here.
See, comparatively, Mechadon is kind of awesome, right?
Yeah, yeah. Great coaches on the sideline. The fans we got are the best of all time. So bring it on if you think you
got it. With the Cleveland Browns and a time to drop it. Yeah, like, oh my God, that's what happened to Kenny Britt. He heard that lyric. He's like, we're the Cleveland Browns. It's time to drop it. And he just drops the ball. It all makes sense. Okay, I found one more. I know we can't just do this forever, but I found more.
Because, what do you mean? Considering we have to cut the first 40 minutes of the show,
okay,
we've only got 25 minutes of show done right now. So
I do feel like we're just hitting
our
stride.
Play away, my friend.
Okay, so this is a song called The Dog Pound. Parentheses, Cleveland Brown song, and the poster says, this is just a song my cousin's band, Anderson Council, wrote like 10 years ago. I just refound it and figured people would like it. And he posted this on, he posted this on November 19th, 2010. So this song is going on 20 years old now. This is by Anderson Council.
By the way, 2010 was not 20 years ago.
Wait a second. Oh, but he says this is a song my cousin's band wrote like 10 years ago.
Oh,
and he said
that
in
2007.
So it would have been from like
from 2000. Got it. Okay, sorry. I get numbers.
Yeah, so not quite 20 years, but like 17 years ago. There has never been a team in the history of professional football with such a following as the Cleveland Browns. And this is their anthem. It's called the Dog's Pound. Whoa, it's the Dog's Pound, not the Dog Pound.
Yeah, it's the Attorney's General.
There has never been an Attorney's General like Eric Holder.
Nope. Oh, man, I want to go back in time.
This person had just listened to a Puddle of Mud CD before they wrote this song. Or something by Stained. What do we do now? The Browns are back. Get revenge. Go on the attack. What do we do to Baltimore? Go and drop kick down that door. Is it a dropkick down the door?
I think so. Is that the thing that you
think about how a dropkick works? It doesn't even make sense.
I don't think so.
A dropkick is kind of, you know, you're coming up with the kick. So you like, let me hear this part.
We missed the screaming.
Were you just singing really high?
I think you're screaming. I'm going to go back a little bit. I want to hear that scream.
Yeah, please do. I don't want to miss any part of this.
Here we go. Twist his neck, make him scream. Nevermore.
Nevermore.
So this is pretty good. Obviously.
God, I love that song.
That's a good song.
Much.
No, it's a very, very good song. But don't you think that
that
this
is totally that song is the kind of song that the guy at the karaoke bar, he has a shaved head and he's pretty cool actually, but he's starting to get more and more drunk, and then he goes up and he sings that song or a song by Stained or a song by Live or a song by Puddle of Mud, and then he's getting more and more drunk. And now his friends have left, and he's at the mm-hmm. bar by himself, and everyone's starting to get weirded out by his energy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that he is not going to leave that bar voluntarily. Someone's going to have to tell him. He's going to get in a fight. The police will be called. Camaro Kevin, I ran into one of these characters at the gate a couple of years ago. He took his shirt off and was trying to fight everybody in the bar. Mm.
Did you fight him?
I didn't, amazingly. I mean, for once, I was not the person making the trouble at that particular bar on that particular night.
I'm going through. I'm looking for other Brown songs, but I'm not seeing any right here. I will play for you this holiday season, not Trucktober, obviously, but the other holiday season, the winter holiday season. I am going to play for you the 12 Days of a Cleveland Browns Christmas, which I think was from the very, very early 80s. I had a 45 record of it growing up. But I'm going to say that. That's my holiday gift to you.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Well, a happy holidays to you.
Thank you.
As well, in advance for that. So I have some possible show titles.
Good.
That I wrote down. Not to make a thing out of everything.
Okay.
Was a thing you said. And then also, no excuses, just apologies.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I'm getting the impression you're not in love with this episode, so that might be appropriate. I also wrote...
I'm not in love with this episode. I'm not in love with the fact that I may have hurt the feelings of an innocent chicken family.
Oh, right.
That's all. I'm just mad at myself because I feel like...
I can take all that out, but then I got to take this out too. How many times do we reference it?
What if you take all that out and leave this in?
Yes. Okay. I'm
going
to try to take everything. Okay. That is a good plan. We'll leave this in.
I love it.
I think there was one other reference to it. There was the main conversation.
It was right. I think it was right getting into top stories.
Good. See? It's fun. It's like a mystery, this show. It's a puzzle. You listening, Tweet Bahara? I also wrote down aspiring, and by the way, the answer to that is no. Aspiring freelance stand-up bassist was another.
Oh, yeah. I asked you to write that down. I like that, too.
What was the second one?
No excuses, just apologies, or the one that you just read that I asked you to write down. I'm ambivalent. I really am. So I'll leave it to you.
What Cat Power song do you want to go out with?
Well, I mean, I feel like I probably at least once, if not twice a year, we play Lived in Bars.
So yeah, let me see if I think we should play something else,
I can find...
I had two albums by her, but I can't remember what they were.
Oh, what about The Greatest? That's probably the other one that I play constantly.
Yeah, I had that album. That was...
She also did a whole covers album too, called The Covers Record.
Right.
She does Satisfaction by the Stones, Wild as the Wind, Dog, Sea of Love. Oh, how about this? Let's do the Sea of Love. Can we do that?
Oh yeah.
I really like her cover of Sea of Love. I think she's playing like an auto harp in it, which is just hilarious because I identify auto harp with my dad playing it at the Bible study.
Oh, I love auto harp.
Our house.
Ooh, right. Our friend Nikki plays auto harp.
I think that Cat Power is better at auto harp than my dad is. God, I love you, Dad.
Yeah, well, let's
see
her build
a sign. My dad tweets under the name Tweet Bahara.
I'm looking now. Now I'm just going down a rabbit hole. Not unlike me looking at a screen and talking about how much I miss L.A. I had this album, You Are Free, too. God, yes. Yeah. I still listen to that. Okay, anyway, the covers record. What?
Doesn't she do that song, Free, where she's yelling free a lot? Off of that record?
Probably. You remember those things better than I do. I'm more of a Mecca Don kind of.
I get you.
These days.
I get you.
Nothing. I've erased every song from my brain that I've ever heard before, that Mecca Don song.
That is in Mecca Don.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be right back here with more Imaginary Radio for you tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the rest of your Thursday. Go eat a bagel. And please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Especially Hartley.
I love you. tell you how much I love you.
Power out.